Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 387th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is generously brought to you by patrons Jason Apple and Ben Donovan. Thanks, guys. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Unlow. Today we've got Chris Pasek on the show. He's the editor behind the new Max series, Telemarketers, which is like a crazy found footage documentary that spans multiple decades, taking down a telemarketer syndicate from the inside out. It's pretty wild, and it's executive produced by the Safdie brothers and Danny McBride. He's also edited episodes of The Vow, the Hillary documentary, all sorts of great stuff. And we have a really cool and insightful conversation with him about what it means to edit documentary and what the role and duty of a editor is in that capacity. It's really fascinating. Oh, also Somebody Feed Phil, which is a personal favorite of mine. So he's got a lot of really great stuff. I loved this conversation.
Yeah, he also has like a background in some narrative film editing. He did a Paul Rudd movie and Ashley Judd movie. So yeah, but it was great talking to him, and hopefully you like it. I just finished watching the show. It's only three episodes. The last episode, I think, is kind of long, but I think altogether it's like a long feature film, mm-hmm. but definitely worth watching. And I think if you at all are into documentary filmmaking or even like YouTube vlogging, like any sort of unscripted filmmaking, mm-hmm. You should check out this show because it's they do an awesome job of using footage, and also the graphics are like all like kind of 90s style fonts.
Mm-hmm. Fun.
It's kind of cool.
It was a really exciting conversation. I think we really do dig in on the philosophy behind editing and documentary. So I really truly love this conversation. And all the episodes are available now on Max. So go check it out there. And before we jump into the conversation with Chris, Oren, I've been dying to know, what have you been working on lately?
Well, thanks for asking, Matt, because I had a color grading session today, mm-hmm. For a job I did a couple weeks ago. And so the color correction session, right, a lot of times like the director will be there. Sometimes the cinematographer will be there. People from the agency might or might not be there. Sometimes we'll do like rounds, like the director gets to set some looks with the DP and the mm-hmm. colorist, and then the agency will come, whatever. I realized our colorist was in LA. I'm in LA, and our cinematographer is in LA. And I said, hey, we're all three of us are in LA. And my cinematographer sent me a text, and he was like, are you going to be in person or remote? And I said, you know what? Why not do it in person, right? Like, mm-hmm. that's how we used to color everything, right? We'd go and we'd sit in a oddly dark room together with gray walls and just talk about like midtones and mm-hmm. a little more magenta here and warm it up. And I was so excited to email our colorist, and then he goes, you know what? My studio is like not exactly set up. I just moved, but don't worry. I'm using Evercast, and it's 10-bit 422 color, and it'll look great. And I was like, okay, fine. So we did this remote color session today, but it really made me think about how COVID is just like ruined post-production. I know this is like, I sound like a broken record because I keep bringing this up, but these last few days, I just realized like why I'm so unhappy with so many of my cuts. And it's because it used mm-hmm. to be that we would just be in the same room. And now, even though we're in the same town, we're in the same city, we're using the same software, it's like no one wants to sit together in the same room mm-hmm. to do this work. And it's driving me crazy because how can you make a good edit without sitting next to each other, without trying 10 different takes and seeing how the music accidentally falls in an interesting mm-hmm. place, you know,
yeah. or
trying different sound effects. And so I was just curious.
Or I even say pointing at things.
Yeah.
You know, like watching them move things around. Yeah, it really bums me out too. And it's funny that you bring it up because at work we're hiring a new editor, like for like kind of a support position. And one of the things that myself and the head of production have both really kind of mandated is that they're here in LA so that we can come in and have FaceTime with them and like talk to them and know them. Like an edit is a live collaborative
tactile thing,
even though it's all on screens. And I think it's really hard for people to be reminded of that. And look, I get it, especially if you're like a colorist or something where most of the work you do with a director or with an EP or whomever, most of the time they don't know what the heck you're doing. You know, most of the time mm-hmm. you're just working solo. And like even I'm pretty hands-on in color, and I know you are as well. And it's maybe my favorite step of the process. Even with the colorists I've worked the most intimately with, there is a certain point where they're just propagating the decisions you've made together. So there's still a good 70% of the time that's like, you don't really need to be there, but you do need to be there for the beginning for a prolonged amount of time, and then to spot check things as well. So like, if I don't have a problem with sitting on the couch and, you know, pulling out my laptop and doing some work as you're doing your independent study, then you shouldn't either. That's part of the gig, you know?
Yeah. And well, to me, what was interesting is that the colorist was saying, like, don't worry, the image quality is going to be great. You don't have to be in the room with me. And to me, I was like, I don't need the image. Like, I'd rather watch this on my iPhone or an iPad or my MacBook, because that's how like 95% of people are going to see this anyway. I don't care about having like a 10-bit giant, you know, 40-inch screen to look at in a perfectly lit room. What I care about is seeing you use like DaVinci and, mm-hmm. you know, like, and what nodes you're putting. A lot of it is because when I do my director's cut and I change out some takes and I want to match my shot to a shot that you graded, I want to remember, like, see how you did it. So mm-hmm. I'm doing kind of a similar mm-hmm. workflow when I'm doing like changing out my shots. And I want to talk to you, and I want to be like, oh, try that sharpening filter. Like, what does that mm-hmm. look like? Mm-hmm. Or about some halation? Like, that's kind of can be cool. Yeah, I don't know. I just feel like so much is lost by not like walking to lunch together and talking about inspiration and mm-hmm. looking. And I don't know. So I'm really in this phase where I'm like on my next job, you know, and whatever. I always come on the podcast and I'm like, I'm going to demand this thing. And then everyone's going to wear name tags on the next set I'm shooting on. And then, you know, it doesn't happen. But like in my mind,
name tags is easy because you can show up with name tags and be like, everyone needs to put one of these on.
Yeah, I did do name tags on my last two shoots, but it's like, it was a little bit of an afterthought, and like only half the people put them on, and they're like, wait, why are we wearing name tags? And I'm like, I asked people to put name tags. Oh, how come? I was like, you know, I just want to know everyone's names. Like, okay, and they're written on the walkie and they're on the call sheet. I'm like, yeah, but you know, I just felt like I was explaining myself and I'm like, who cares? I know who I know, who I need to know. But now I kind of want to be like, hey, I want to be in the room with the editor, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, thanks for listening, Matt. And thanks for your insight. If you all have any thoughts on in-person versus remote, I'm assuming many of our listeners probably love remote working because they don't have to be in LA to be involved in everything, which is also great. But, you know, I prefer being in person. Personally. Mm-hmm.
Well, without further delay, let's talk about Patreon. Patreon.com/JustShootAPod is the place where you can throw us a buck or two to keep this show going. We know it's hard out there for filmmakers, so every little bit helps. If you've gotten something out of the show, if you've made a short film or a feature film, or you pitched on something recently and you used something that we taught you or one of our guests taught you, more likely, consider throwing us a buck or two, because it is the thing that pays for our editor and all of our other fees, of which there are many. It really helps us out and keeps us emotionally engaged with the show.
Well, yeah, check it out, patreon.com/justshootapod. We really appreciate it. And without further delay, let's move on to the rest of the show.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, hey, we are here with Chris Passig, editor of Telemarketers and many other shows, including Feed Phil, which I believe, Matt, was your unpaid endorsement about 2 years ago.
Somebody Feed Phil.
Sure.
Somebody sure. Feed Phil.
Oh, Somebody Feed Phil. Sorry, I saw the abridged version.
Yeah.
Thanks, Chris, for coming on.
Yeah, sure.
Show.
Thanks for having me. So exciting.
So, Chris, can you tell us a little bit about Telemarketers and how you got involved in it?
Sure, yeah. I had worked with a producer, Claire Reed, on The Vow, who thought I might be a good fit. I live in New Jersey. I hadn't been in New York City in 2 years. It's kind of like seriously leaving the cave, going to New York for the first time since everything shut down. And meeting Sam Lippman-Stern, who's in our show as the young man working at the call center, and our co-director, Adam Lowe. It was really a perfect match in that, you know, Sam... This is a film in like this post-industrial kind of crummy New Jersey city. Sam is this dropout and he's friends with Pat Pespis, you know, our other main character, who's an addict. And, you know, I had a very similar experience when I was 18 as our character. So we kind of were able to bond on that. And took
how,
from there.
How similar?
Like, you know,
did you work as a telemarketer, Chris?
I didn't work as a telemarketer, but I did work in a call center. I wasn't selling, I was helping folks. I also, though, spent about a year as a dropout working as a mover, which, a lot like the call center and telemarketers, you know, the rest of the workforce was, you know, a lot of folks from halfway homes and yeah, just kind of had an appreciation for that scene that Sam was in. So
I saw the show. Matt hasn't seen it yet, but one of the interesting things about it is that it really is made up of a lot of found footage. You know, for our listeners that don't know much about the show, it's basically about these two guys that work at a telemarketing company and realize that they're part of this giant scam and they're trying to figure out what to do about it. But it's really kind of like a buddy comedy, and a lot of it is based on this footage that they were filming, 15 years ago, you know, while they were working at this call center. And so I imagine, Chris, like one of the things that got me excited about having you on and about watching it is I saw like the Safdie brothers were EPs on it, and it's on HBO, and there's like a lot of...
And Danny McBride.
Oh, yeah, Danny McBride.
Sure, yeah.
It's real. Folks, HBO, yeah. Trifecta right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He knows the foot fist way, that guy.
Sure.
And so I'm curious, like, to me, if I was like, here's two dudes that like know nothing about filming, very little about filmmaking, that right. recorded themselves 15 years ago on like VHS cameras or whatever.
Right.
And now they want to make a docuseries out of it. And I don't even know what the ending is yet. Like, I'd probably like not be that interested in working on this project. It just because it's like it could lead to nothing. So I'm curious, like you as the editor, who sure. obviously are like kind of a critical part of telling the story, like what got you convinced that this was even like worthwhile telling, aside from like, connecting with the characters?
So Adam, our co-director, has kind of spoken to this also, but you know, I saw a promo that was about 5 minutes long, and really all I needed to see was Pat. You know, the promo I saw had Pat, you know, scenes from the show where he snorted heroin in the car and going to complete his sales. There was a scene of him kind of explaining, you know, that the name of the company is CDG, might as well stand for Criminals Doing Good. He was just so charismatic that I just kind of felt from the beginning that, you know, beyond the issue of telemarketing fraud, like this was a once in a lifetime documentary character that I had always hoped to have my hands on. So I was kind of sold right from the get. And then the found footage thing is interesting because, same thing, Adam, our co-director, kind of has astutely put it that like it's not exactly found footage because we have the guy that shot it, you know what I mean? So like something like Winnebago Man or something like that, like it's a mystery and you're never going to get the insight from the person of what they were going for with it. Whereas this, you know, we have Sam. He had hundreds of tapes in his closet and you know, 20 hours of 12-year-olds doing bong hits, which for, you know, he was a juvenile delinquent, and before he was at the call center, he was filming him and his buddies just kind of fucking around and skateboarding and doing graffiti, and they're all, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old. So, but yeah, that said, I'm a huge fan of found footage stuff. You know, when I met the team on this, my mind immediately went to Heavy Metal Parking Lot of just the, you know, our show kept the comedy and sort of flavor of a found footage thing, but was unique in that, yeah, like we are pushing a story forward and yeah, like we are kind of in that construct of a true crime show. I guess we didn't really think we were ever making a true crime show, so to speak. But yeah, it was like, let's have that vibe of like a great found footage piece and put it in this new, you know, present it in this new way.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the other shows that you cut is The Vow. And I'm just realizing in this conversation that there's kind of a shared DNA in so much as you have this wealth of archival footage, the quote unquote 100 VHS tapes in the closet.
Yeah. Right. The Vow was like a guy that was also trying to document
it. He was trying to document it. Yep. Right. Yep. But then you also have the characters in present day reflecting back on things and adding a little bit of context, clarifying things, all that. On a practical level, I'm curious.
Sure.
How you go about employing that to your advantage, right? Like, I imagine yeah. you're doing some version of a string out with the archival stuff and then putting together a wish list of sound bites and things like that. Walk us through that, the interaction between archival and present day footage.
I think on any show, telemarketers is different because it's just sort of one of a kind that like, it was so singular and we didn't even know if we wanted interviews with people. Like we did some proof of concepts, like they're smoking, they're drinking in the interviews. They like their memories are fuzzy. Like we really leaned into, we let the like rough around the edges sort of amateur nature bleed into those interviews. But regardless, like any kind of thing where you have a big archival element, yeah, you want that to be your spine, honestly. I definitely prefer shows where those sit-down interviews are supporting the archival and not the other way around. I think it's personally, like I would tell people, it's like building from the inside out. So yeah, you got to screen all that archival. You're earmarking what is going to work in a 5 or 10 second clip, but what you're really looking for is the sort of tent pole pieces that you don't need to explain, and you don't need to cut to an interview for, and what can speak for itself for as long as possible.
And when you say, Chris, what you're looking for, are you saying like you literally are the editor just sitting there by yourself in a room with all the footage and just looking for pieces of footage that can be the tent poles? Or are you having like a sit down with the directors and the filmmakers and the producers and like really planning it out on paper with like, hey, act one is going to be this.
Yeah.
Act two.
Because how is it broken?
I did read this article that said that Benny Safdie maybe had pitched the 3-episode structure.
Well, yeah. So Telemarketers was unique in that, Telemarketers kind of had this built-in episode structure in that, you know, we have these time jumps, you know what I mean? So our first episode, the place they're working at gets shut down, and then a couple of years later, they pick up, you know, an investigation in it. That investigation at the end of 2 hits a major snag with one of our characters' personal lives, and it's almost 10 years before they pick it back up again. So we kind of had that built in. We'd always have a loose outline going in of like what the acts are going to be. A lot of times with Great Archival, it's not always like necessarily pushing the story forward as much as is illuminating character. So you kind of can't totally prepare for the goal. You know what I mean? You know, your director, the person that shot it, you know, whoever's baby this is going to have an idea of what they like and what's going to go in. But yeah, I think there's definitely a long screening process, and, you know, a good editor is going to have different eyes as to what it can do.
Were they still shooting while you were editing?
Our third episode, present day investigation, they were starting to shoot. They had shot a little bit before I came on, but yeah, most of the third episode was shot while I was cutting the first 2.
So is there a scenario where you're like, hey, we could use more B-roll for this, or like, go get, it would be nice if there was an interview with this type of person.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's tricky to apply the lessons of Telemarketers to anything else, because the old callers, by and large, they're all still like Facebook friends with our director, but, you know, they're all hardworking folks, and they're not film people. They're not, you know, they're not professional talking heads. So their availability would drive more than what I could get. You know what I mean? Like, if we could find some dude who's in this grainy footage from 2003, like, we'll take what we can get, and we'll find a way. The thing that made this project so unique is, yeah, like this, you know, these folks are involved in this huge scam. They were all, you know, plenty of people there were working for years and years. And when they got shut down, everyone got fired. The guys who own the company, you know, everyone thinks they're working in some crummy little sort of pissant company in an office park. And meanwhile, the owners, when they get caught, they get hit with the largest fine in consumer protection history, $20 million. They're getting Van Gogh's taken away. They're getting $250,000 wine collections taken away. Like, even now, so many people could not conceive of what they were involved in. So those interviews, like, you're only going to get so much, you know what I mean? They're supporting you know, they're giving kind of tall tales of this wild office that gets to play really nicely with the wild office stuff that we get to see in the show.
Yeah, totally. It kind of reminded me a little bit of like the Jinx, in that you have like all this kind of archival, these crazy things that happened like many years ago, but also still today, there are people that are involved in the documentary that are still kind of like, probably should go to jail, you know? And so you have to like hide their faces and hide their voices. And there is like a little bit of a live, like, is someone going to get arrested as a result of this documentary, like in real time as it's coming out on HBO, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
An interesting dynamic.
We had, in our third episode, one of our, you know, our guys meet this, you know, they're amateur journalists. They meet a real journalist who's been working on this, the story of this stuff for a while. And she plays a tape of this telemarketing sort of kingpin who, you know, chased her through a parking garage, and she recorded his audio. Yeah. He got arrested, I want to say within the past 2 weeks, criminal charges.
Oh, wow.
These guys just generally don't ever face, you know, that's kind of the reason why this is like this unsolvable problem. It's, you know, these places get hit with these,
right. Cause they're going after the police.
Right. Yeah. There's that part too.
Oh, you said that there isn't a lot from telemarketers that would apply to other documentaries. But the one thing that I did notice about it is that, it has like really good sound, like all the way from episode one, when these guys were just like filming each other,
sure,
like at their workplace, probably on really crappy cameras. Can you tell us a little bit about like some of the technical stuff? Like how do you get such great audio out of like such old footage?
I mean, the short answer is, not to blow up any mix or spot, but, AI. you know, there's tools now. Yeah. So when I was cutting with a lot of that stuff, there was just like an insane buzz from the Super 8 camera, in all of it, to the point where like we didn't think it was necessarily going to go away. We had a period where we were recording voiceover on beat up old cameras so that it would blend into the fabric of the show. Eventually our mixer was able to alleviate a whole lot of that, with tools that are kind of brand new. Even that, like it's funny to hear you say that. We, you know, both our kind of colorist and our mixer were kind of, you know, when we got started, it was just a constant torrent of us saying, you know, make it look shittier, make it sound crummier, make it look worse, make it sound worse, you know,
great. Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's, you know, same thing, just leaning into the found footage and amateur nature of our stuff that, you know, we all kind of had to think backwards, in a way.
Well, and I love the idea of leaning into the nature and the medium of the footage that you have, but I think there's a big difference between texture and legibility, right?
Sure.
Like your point about like, oh, recording voiceover into these old tools to make them a little rough around the edges makes complete sense. That's texture, but like the AI is there to like help make sure that things are literally clear for an audience, which is an interesting balance to strike, to use like the most bleeding edge tools and also a camera I bought them with paperboy money, you know, in 2003.
Sure.
It's like a funny dichotomy to have, for sure.
That, and that sort of applied to everything that we did, in that, you know, we had all this amazing archival, especially of the wireless in the office, but you know, how long can you expect an audience? How long can you expect, you know, an HBO audience even to, you know, you can't sit and watch guys smashing keyboards over their heads and, you know, getting wasted at the office and all of these crazy hijinks for, you know, 3 hours. You have to, you know, you have to have that sort of sophisticated storytelling, as well. So yeah, that was the constant balance on this one.
I'm curious, just on a truly practical level, what sort of documents you're working off of? You're screening everything together, right? But then are you literally putting together a script where you're like listing out different bytes that you're hoping for? Do you have a transcript with you? Like, what does that first from screening everything into that first draft, what does that look like? And really, like, what medium are you drafting in?
Sure. Yeah. I think in general, and just to expand it past telemarketer, like I would say is, anytime I'd be working with something that, where there are a lot of interviews, I would generally watch everything while I have a transcript at the same time. I'm highlighting the transcript kind of as I go, both for stuff that's sticking out, as, you know, great story beat, or great character. Then doing that for all the interviews, then taking those transcripts, taking those highlights, copying out all those highlighted selects into a new document, and sort of then organizing each interview's selects by topic, so that's one level of organization, and then beyond that, then making a new document that's interview by topic, and so that way you can have your seven people talking about this one topic and have it all in one place and start thinking about how they can bounce off each other. What was that Dr. Dre documentary? The Defiant Ones. There was an article that those guys did where that was their process, and that's like a genius thing. When schedules get shortened and budget gets tighter, there's a process out there where story producer and maybe an assistant editor are pulling video selects to watch back. And editors inheriting those, which is not particularly the way I like to go. I really think that's the writing of the show. You know what I mean? The organizing what you think is good and starting to build a script off of that. Yeah, that's your foundation. So I try to be the one doing that.
Yeah. And I think that maybe that cuts to the quick of what I was maybe not realizing I was really asking. It's like, who writes the show? And it sounds like, with all due respect to all of your collaborators, like that's the process, right? Like it's the craft is in what's in and what's out, right?
Yeah.
And it is fascinating to think about how with an archival show in particular, you just have to have ingested all of that interview footage in order to be able to crack that nut.
Totally. And I think, I think any documentary editor will tell you that, there's just more authorship in editing documentary than there is, a narrative thing, which is, I was in narrative before I got into doc, and, the first doc I did, I sort of fell in love with that aspect of it for sure.
Well, how does a show like Somebody Feed Phil, which has very much a format, and hey, we're going to Singapore or whatever, everything we film here is what is going to be used for this next episode. Do you find that easier and like more enjoyable, or is it less challenging but rewarding in other ways? Like how do you compare editing a show like that with a show like Telemarketers?
Sure. I mean, that show like that, it's tricky because that wasn't exactly my experience on that one, because I cut the premiere of it. So we had a sense of what it was going to be and we had the footage, but we're still working out,
You're like, boy, I hope Phil likes this canola.
Yeah. Totally.
If not,
totally,
we're sunk.
Totally. But like a show like that, I think one of the reasons that show is so successful is like, as much as there is you know, you know where he's going. You have a rough sense of what order it's going to go in. You know, you're going to want to follow the trajectory he was actually on. But the thing that makes that show special is it's not that different than Cutting Standard documentary. If there's a scene where Phil doesn't like the food and it's entertaining and there's some humanity in it, you know, it makes the show. you know, whether it's something like Telemarketers or The Vow, it's always a combination of like, you know, you're trusting me with this footage. We're having like a broad conversation at first of what you want it to be. And then, you know, you're trusting me to find that space with you that where what I'm envisioning and what you're envisioning line up, you know?
With The Vow or with Telemarketers, though, there is, you know, there's the mandate of like there's a clear goal that these characters are trying to take down a bigger entity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with Somebody Feed Phil, like if he doesn't like the cannoli
sure.
at this, you know, vendor's shop, like at the pilot, you don't really know this, but it, like, I think like lots of food tourism shows, the publicity that they get from these shows is a huge
yeah.
deal, right?
Yeah.
And can make or break a business.
Sure.
So I wonder now if the process is informed by that responsibility in some way. Do you know what I mean? Like, as a person, I think Phil is probably, he's a big fan of food. So like, you don't want to disparage a
sure.
independent business.
Sure, with, sure, sure,
with
sure.
not
sure,
liking
sure.
their cannoli or,
sure.
or whatever.
Sure.
And so I wonder, are there other circumstances where, you know, you almost feel a responsibility to pull a punch or to be less truthful or leave something out in documentary?
So this is an interesting spot for sure. So, yeah, I mean, the short answer is no, in that there are. And yeah, you can expand this.
Yeah.
You can expand this to. Yeah, to any kind of documentary of that. Yes, that responsibility to what you're filming and who's responsible. And, you know, there's
mm-hmm.
there's editors that I like and I respect. And I think they do great work. Who I've seen say things like, you know, I saw someone say that, you know, the act of going on camera is this act of generosity, and you have to honor that. And that's sort of the opposite of my approach. And honestly, what brought me, you know, to Telemarketers in the first place, that's not my job. Is to an editor's job is to an audience, right? And that's kind of the director, and in my mind, that's the director and the producer's job. An editor needs to cut themselves off from the subject as much as humanly possible. Mm-hmm. And
you're not there to protect them; you're there to
I'm there for to
tell
make
a story.
Exactly, yeah. Tell a story and entertain an audience. I might just be extra sensitive to this because the documentaries that I love don't pull punches with their subjects. My editing style usually will require a producer or a director to have a hard conversation with the subject, you know, something, you know, is going to make the cut that they probably don't love, but, and you don't need to like throw people under the bus or like over milk that kind of stuff. But like, I think that's, you don't want to, you want an audience to resonate with the people in the film as much as possible. So if you overly protect them, it kind of doesn't serve anybody, I don't think. And I mean, Jesus, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt, Chris. I was gonna ask what your take is on like all the music documentaries, like the Beyonce, you know, Taylor Swift, Selena Gomez, the like Miley Cyrus, because a lot of these
and sports documentaries too.
Sure,
you're saying like where the subject is also the EP.
Yeah,
yeah,
and like how like I love the Taylor Swift one because you know that you. I got a sense of her process, you know, I loved it from like a craft point of view, but like, you know, and she talked about like the Kanye moment, you know, when he told her, he said on world stage, she shouldn't have received the Grammy or whatever it was. Like you really got her point of view, but you didn't get like, you know, like a filmmaker's point of view on like the good and the bad. Like you don't see, you never see any of these people be tyrants or be,
right,
you know, like have faults.
Sure. Yeah. Right? I mean, I think, listen, I think that it's not impossible to make a great movie where your subject is an EP and that's the way of the world. And, I'm a little tricky of a person to ask because I don't watch a lot of movies when they come out. I have this thing where, I don't want it to inform the work I'm doing now, and B, I kind of want whatever critical consensus or hype around something to like have dissipated by the time I watch it. So I'm usually a good 5 to 10 years in the documentary. But at the same time, when you like, if there's someone who's just that compelling of a personality, like a Taylor Swift or a Beyonce, you know, I did this Hillary Clinton documentary, very similar, where, you know, she's sitting down and she's, you know, she gave a 30, very revealing 30 hour, 4-part interview that we used. But she's, you know, she's a very guarded person. And that movie, she very candidly talked about her tensions with Bernie, and kind of some lingering resentment. And at the end of the day, like, you know, that's the stuff that made the headlines with that movie. So even in something like that, I think, you know, I just think audiences appreciate candor. And yeah, and they, regardless of who the person is, I think people can identify with people who allow themselves to be vulnerable on camera. It's kind of the secret sauce to telemarketers. You know, this movie couldn't exist with a filmmaker going into one of these call centers and trying to make the movie because they'd be a tourist. You know what I mean? Like this is like, it gets to, you know, we have a co-director who describing his time there as like being the bottom rung of society, you know, and he has these voiceovers where he's referring to himself as a scumbag and him and his friends as little pieces of shit. And, you know, like if you hear a subject calling themselves that in the first 5 minutes of a movie, like, you know, there's a buy-in and there's like a trust in a narrator who isn't holding back. So, but yeah, that said, then, you know, if you're making a movie about a virtuoso, like a movie like that, maybe you don't. And maybe it's just, you know, the power of a virtuoso, you know, on a grand scale in front of you, is the way to go.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I do, you know, it's interesting, like even like the Billie Eilish documentary I'm thinking of right now, like it's interesting what those documentaries serve. And it's like a lot of it is about, is they're making it for their fans, right? It's like not necessarily for like new people to discover them. It's like for their fans to get an even more intimate look inside of their lives, which I mean, ultimately just, I think, especially nowadays, you know, when we talk about like the YouTubers and like the people, your fans of people that you feel like you know so well, as opposed to, you know, back in the day, like when we were fans of celebrity, like nobody knows anything about Tom Cruise's personal life.
Right.
You know, but nowadays, like it's a different thing. I had my kind of last big question was going to be about your transition from narrative to documentary. Like I see, according to IMDb, you edited a couple movies, Big Stone Gap, The Fundamentals of Caring, big kind of, you know, Paul Rudd, Ashley Judd films.
Sure.
Like it seemed like films with people that we recognize. Like, what did you learn on those films that you brought into documentary editing? And I guess the second part of the question is, like, would you go back to narrative, or is documentary Are you just so power hungry that you'll never want to leave the documentary space?
I think it would be hard to go back. I mean, I think that for a number of projects, just having experience in comedy helps you, you know, just the rhythm of, you know, the rhythm of a comedic documentary is not that different than, you know, cutting a comedic narrative. That Paul Rudd movie specifically is a road trip movie, which road trips make their way into docs. Telemarketers has a piece. So I think from that one, I learned that it's impossible to make a road trip movie without getting a note of get these guys on the road faster. I think.
So one last thing before we kind of go into our unpaid endorsements.
Sure.
Before we started recording, you talked about how you were on vacation in Maine.
Sure.
And you had said that you had just kind of come off of two films in a row and needed a break. Can you tell us like a little bit about like that, like how, you know, at this point you've done so many feature length things, you've done so many TV episodes, like how do you like not get overwhelmed and like how do you not get scared that if you, you know, leave town for a month, like people will stop calling you? Like, can you just tell us a little bit about the psychology of like how you have a consistent career and like mentally like keep it all together?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one thing I do is look at the bill for my house. That's a motivator.
Wait, we said how to not get overwhelmed, Chris.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, it's picking projects that there's a good chance you're going to love. You know what I mean? I think kind of the thrill of cracking a story, the thrill of making something so unique, kind of carries that through, you know? The creative process itself is so rewarding and exciting and addictive thing. It was funny. So you brought up that Paul Rudd thing. I cut that movie and wasn't really sure what I was going to do after. I had just kind of like gotten in the narrative world, and yeah, and like it's a fun movie and people really like it, but it wasn't really leading to other stuff. So I had this like 6 month period where I was just sort of green and didn't know how much I had to hustle for myself, and yeah, I kind of like burned the money I had saved cutting that movie. Kind of ever since then, I'm just kind of, you know, always back of mind thinking of the next one. Whereas now, like, you know, I don't, if I chose time off, I don't think there would be so much of a waiting period. But I still get excited pretty much about any project that comes my way, just even to learn about. So, yeah, I think it's just really loving what you're doing.
Well, before we do our unpaid endorsements, how can people find out what you're working on next? What's after vacation?
Sure.
Learn yeah. more about your projects. Are you on Instagram?
I am on Instagram, WM Jumpstart. Yeah, that's kind of the main spot. I usually don't say much until the thing is done. I think that's maybe just a self-check.
Your selfies from know? Editor Bay.
No, yeah, no one really cares about the selfies from an editor. Sure, editor Instagrams usually fall in a number of categories. One is like I'm really tired, like I'm really tired post. Then there's a here's a snap of my timeline, my finished timeline. That's a classic editor.
I like the timeline ones for sure. Sure.
Yeah.
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 Just a clean timeline. Yeah. Just like really nice and tidy. I like that. Yeah.
That's probably why I don't ever post any of mine, because they're there's, you know, 100 tracks on top and 100 tracks on the bottom. WM Jumpstart on Instagram. That would be the spot.
Awesome. Chris, well, do you have a few more minutes to endorse with us?
Sure, please.
Unpaid endorsements.
So I've got two endorsements. They're truly cribbing directly from our conversation One, Chris, you brought it up, is a heavy metal parking lot.
Yeah.
Which is found footage. It's not truly found footage, but it's like a classic rock and roll movie about like dudes basically tailgating before metal shows, that it feels sort of ambient and transitory in the way that, like, I think a lot of the stuff that we talked about could, you know. Sure. I think, Chris, you do a great job of like adding more narrative thrust to your work, but it's still kind of meant to have this sort of like fly on the wall verite sort of moment, and you just kind of can't believe these crazy characters. And then as a sidecar, Decline of Western Civilization, which is you know, kind of the follow up to that, which is about punk instead. She did Decline of the Western Civilization Part 2, which is the metal years, which is not the same as Heavy Metal Parking Lot. But yeah. Yeah, real shaggy, those movies, in a way that's really fun and strange and weird. So those are my endorsements.
We
sure. Well, and Winnebago Man. I'd forgotten all about that movie until you mentioned it, and really defined South by Southwest for a couple of years, I feel like, yeah, especially in the doc space.
Heavy Metal Parking Lot might be my favorite movie, and it we had when I first met with Sam and Adam to talk about Telemarketers, that was like the first thing I brought up of how it reminded me of that. And we had a watch party at my house the other day for the second episode that we kicked off with Heavy Metal Parking Lot to start us off. Yeah. It was a Time magazine on, I think, our review brought it up, which was a thrill to see Heavy Metal Parking Lot name dropped in our review in Time.
That is very exciting. Can I ask, where did you watch it? What's the best place to see Heavy Metal Parking Lot? Because I'm seeing some YouTube rips, but I wonder if there's a better way to watch it.
I think YouTube is the way. I know that they did just release a DVD, even a Blu-ray I bought, but I haven't put in yet. There's a lot of extras. But yeah, that was a tape trader's tape back in the day. So I think watching on YouTube is very much in the spirit. Mm-hmm. Of Heavy Metal Parking Lot.
Sure. Yeah. That's great. Awesome. Well, Chris, I feel bad for stepping on your vibe, but what are you endorsing?
So yeah, I am endorsing a movie that's, I don't think it's available to stream anywhere. You may have to go to some dark corners of the internet to find it. But it's a movie that was an HBO documentary in the 90s called Small Town Ecstasy, which is about, it's a documentary about a middle-aged father of two who has this break. I think he's going through a divorce or a separation, and he decides to become a raver and go to raves all the time. And dressed like a 19-year-old raver from like 1997, takes his kids to raves. And I recommend it just because it kind of reminds me of Telemarketers in that, like, yeah, it's so gritty, it's so scrungy, it's so raw. It kind of has that 90s HBO documentary feel, you know, if you're a fan of that early Todd Phillips stuff, like what was the Frat House movie? I think it's just called Frat House, or like the hated G.G. Allen movie. Small Town Ecstasy, a lot like Telemarketers, wades into really, really, really dark territory, but kind of gleefully splashes around in it and has fun with it.
Kaplan, what you got, bud?
I've got a good one actually this week. It's a Trader Joe's. It's the Trader Joe's dill salad. Have either one of you guys had this?
No, it sounds good though. I like dill.
It's like, you know, a bunch of green stuff, kale, cabbage, all these things, you know, that are healthy. But then it comes with like some dill powder that you put on top of it. And then this like dill dressing, like a kind of white, kind of creamy dill dressing. But the best part of it is it comes with like dill potato chips. And you put them on the salad and you mix the whole thing together. And it's so, if you even remotely like pickles whatsoever, this is like such a good salad. It's just, you know, it's like a bag that comes fully made and you can just eat the whole thing by yourself for lunch. And you're like, wow, I had a healthy lunch and it was delicious. And it's like $5. So, Chris, I do a lot of tasting new things from Trader Joe's.
Sure.
I especially if my wife's not there, I will buy anything that catches my eye, and then I will tend to give honest reviews on the podcast. So
I love it. I'm a
Trader
big
Joe's
fan of
dill
the,
salad.
The Trader
Amazing.
Joe's frozen section. Trader Joe's Indian curry.
Oh yeah,
it's got me through a tough time.
I can't let it go in the frozen section. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's a joke. If you have a 5-year-old daughter, you might understand.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, thanks again, Chris, for coming on. Everyone should check out your show. It's wild. And if you want to ask us anything or you want us to forward Chris any questions, let us know what you think about documentary filmmaking. Anything, you can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can find us across all social media at justshootitpod. I'm on Instagram at okaplan.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow across all social media, including Letterboxd. And I've been getting a few followers, so...
Oh, come on.
It's very exciting to me. It's really great. It's truly motivating me to post better Letterboxd content. I was like, oh, maybe I'll become a Letterboxd influencer. Like our friend and listener, Andy Young.
Okay.
He's a Letterboxd influencer. He's, you know, he's got a following. It's cool. But there's not a better... better social media out there. Anyway, this episode was edited by Noah Bayshore. Thanks, Noah. I bet Noah's on Letterboxd too, and he's certainly on TikTok. Give him a follow. And you're listening to music provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Chazar. Thanks, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.